The following sermon was preached at Emmanuel Baptist Church in Jessup, Georgia. Visit our website at www.evcjessup.net. I invite you to open your Bibles this morning to the book of Ecclesiastes as we continue our series in this book, this wisdom book. In many ways, a very difficult yet rewarding book, Ecclesiastes chapter number 2. And this is our third sermon from this book as we begin to move into its main body of the book together. When I was a young man, there was a popular rock song sung by the Rolling Stones, and the name of the song was "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." And in the song, they bemoaned the fact they can't find any satisfaction. In one verse, it says, "Riding in my car and listening to the radio and all that the man's saying, I can't get no satisfaction." And another one, sitting and listening to the TV and listening to the commercials and all that's said, and I can't get no satisfaction. And another one's about traveling around the world and signing autographs and touring everywhere, and I can't get no satisfaction. And the repeated refrain, Mick Jagger belts out, "I can't get no satisfaction, because I've tried and I try and I try, and I can't get no satisfaction." Another hymn, or not another hymn, another song I remember from my youth was a hymn entitled, "I'll Be Satisfied." And that song says, "When my soul is singing in the promised land above, I'll be satisfied, praising Christ the Savior for redeeming grace and love, I'll be satisfied." That hymn is based on Psalm 17:15, and I suppose the song by the Rolling Stones was based on their own observation and their pursuit of satisfaction, and they couldn't find any. But the hymn was based upon Psalm 17:15, which says, "As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness." One is to travel and enjoy the experiences of life, a believer. But as we travel around, I suppose our testimony is, be it ever so humble, there is no place like home. And no matter how much joy this world may render us, the believer is saying there is no place like home. Believers are pilgrims. We are sojourners. We're traveling. And we are to enjoy God and His blessings immensely in our journey. But we are pilgrims who will not completely be satisfied until we get home, until I behold the face of the Lord and I awake in His likeness. The book of Ecclesiastes is about the search for meaning. It's about the search for satisfaction. It is about finding happiness in the journey of life. And Stuart Olliott's commentary on Ecclesiastes, entitled A Life Worth Living, he notes that Ecclesiastes is composed of three basic components. There is the introduction, verses 1 through 11 of chapter 1 that we have looked at. Then there are four sermons in the main body of the book. There are four sermons. The first one is chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 3, verse 15. The second sermon picks up at chapter 3, verse 16, goes through chapter 5, verse 20. And the third sermon picks up in chapter 6, verse 1, and goes through chapter 8, verse 13. And the fourth sermon picks up in chapter 8, verse 14, and goes through chapter 12, verse 7. And then, of course, there is the conclusion, the summary of the book, and that is in chapter 12, verses 8 through 14. In each of the four sermons, Ollyett says that the preacher expounds two themes. And we've talked about this already somewhat. But he expounds the two themes of futility, seeing the world from only a worldview, an unbeliever's view, and hope, seeing life and all that there is from a believer's viewpoint. So he wears these two hats, the preacher does, as he goes into this. On the one hand, he shows us futility. And then he will briefly put on the other hat and he will show us hope and meaning. Then he'll move to the next sermon and he'll repeat that theme with futility. And show us futility. And then he'll put on the other hat and show us hope. And on through the sermons. There is a phrase that is repeated numerous times in the book. And if you have a concordance, you can just look up this phrase, under the sun. Excuse me. Under the sun. That phrase is used just over and over and over and over in the book. And usually, I think probably without exception, when he uses the phrase under the sun, he's talking about an earthbound life. He's talking about a view of life that's totally secular. And the conclusion of that life is it's meaningless. It doesn't have any meaning. There is, as we looked at the last time, relentless, repetitious vanity. That's all there is in that life. And then there is the God-focused life. That is a life of progress, of purpose. It is a life where there is to be found meaning, meaningfulness, and yes, even happiness, godly happiness and joy that the believer experiences now in his journey and ultimately his satisfaction when he beholds the Lord face to face. Which really brings us to a question before we read the chapter. What do you think would bring you happiness? I know when I was a little boy, my cousin and I, we used to play cars and trucks. Didn't always have cars and trucks to play with, but we would take a brick bat and boy, we made some really nice roadways and bridges and tunnels and parking lots, and we could take our little 2x4 blocks and we could play all day long. And I even remember thinking then, I can't wait till I get older where I can buy cars and trucks and play cars and trucks. When I got older, I didn't care to play cars and trucks. I haven't spent my money trying to buy little cars and trucks to push around and play with. But I used to think that would bring me happiness. Seriously. What is it that you think today would bring you happiness? And then the next question, of course, is why? Why do you think whatever it is that you answered, why do you think that will do it? Let's look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 as we consider the subject searching for satisfaction. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guiding me with wisdom. and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept from my heart no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and all the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner He has given the busyness of gathering and collecting. only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. May God bless His Word, and may His people say,
Amen.
Contentment is an elusive virtue. It is what the Puritan preacher Jeremiah Burroughs referred to as a rare jewel. Contentment, a rare jewel. Paul said in Philippians chapter 4, verse 11, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. Now, Paul says that contentment was not that which came natural to him, but it was something he had learned. I have learned in whatever situation I am in to be content. And the word content there means needing no assistance. In other words, as he's writing to the Philippians, he's saying to them, I've been sometimes, because I haven't been supported as a missionary, I've been hungry, sometimes I haven't had the support that I needed. I've learned to just to depend, to rely upon what I have, whatever it is, and to be content with that. In those situations, to limit my desires, to limit my requirements. I can only wear one pair of shoes. I can only wear one hat. I can only wear one coat. So be content with that. He said, I've learned this lesson of contentment. David said in Psalm 131, I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. As Tim Keller notes, an unweaned child cries in his mother's arms until he gets something from his mother, her milk. But a weaned child in his mother's arms is satisfied just with his mother herself, just to be in her presence. David says, I have stilled my soul like a weaned child. I am happy and find satisfaction just in the presence of God Himself. Now let's note that there is a huge difference between contentment and complacency. When Paul said, I have learned to be content in whatever state I am in, he's talking about physical contentment. Paul was never spiritually content in the sense that he became apathetic. Even when he's in prison expecting execution, he writes Timothy and he asks Timothy, bring me the books and the parchments. What's he going to do with the books and the parchments? He's going to be studying. He's going to be giving himself over to pursuing God. And that's what he said in another situation. I don't account myself to have apprehended, but I'm pressing on. I'm pressing toward the mark. And so there is a huge difference and distinction that needs to be made and understood between contentment, being contented, and yet not being apathetic. And I think a lot of times we find people that are growing complacent spiritually, not pursuing in the way that Paul pursued with all of his being to be fully in the presence of God and to apprehend God with all of his faculties. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes is about the preacher's search for contentment and meaning. In Ecclesiastes 1, he seeks meaning and satisfaction through knowledge and through wisdom. And notice back in chapter 1, verse 15, he acknowledges that there are some problems that knowledge and wisdom can't fix. He says in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There are some problems in life that you can have the wisdom of Solomon himself, you can have all the knowledge of mankind, and you can't fix the problem with your wisdom and your knowledge. A person may know the future and know what's going to happen in the future. They don't, but suppose that they could for a moment. Doesn't mean they can change the future. We can look around at the world and we can say one of the great problems in the world is sin. That is the big problem in the world is sin. The problem with people, sometimes we say, what's wrong with people? And the answer is sin. Sin is the problem. But I can't make a crooked stick straight. I can have all that knowledge. You can have all of that wisdom. We can understand. But that will not by itself fix the problem. And so Solomon says, there's some things that wisdom and knowledge can't fix. It's not that wisdom and knowledge are bad, but they're limited. There are limitations here. In chapter 1, verse 18, he also makes another observation about wisdom. He says that it brings much vexation, and who increases knowledge increases sorrow. You know, again, I think that we often live like the proverbial ostrich with our head in the sand, and we don't want to know certain things because we know if we know them, it's going to cause us some consternation and trouble. Well, Solomon is a man of great wisdom and great knowledge, and that great wisdom and great knowledge served him well. But it also brought him distress. And that's what knowledge and wisdom often does. It brings great unrest and distress of mind and of heart. In Ecclesiastes 2, the preacher continues his search for contentment and meaning in the first part through pleasure. He says, since learning and knowledge bring sorrow, he determines to seek contentment in amusement. And he says in verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Odd, I've seen the limits of knowledge and wisdom. They're good things, but some things they can't fix. And so I'm going to pursue something else. I'm going to pursue amusement and pleasure. Have your go at it. Fill yourself with it. The question is, can pleasure and carnal joy give lasting satisfaction and fulfillment? Eve thought so. She jettisoned the Word of God because she saw something that was pleasing to the eyes and had a desire that would be pleasing to taste. And had an appeal to her inner being that she could be wise like God. And she jettisoned everything for a bite of the forbidden fruit. Seems that many today agree with Eve. And their major pursuit is pleasure. I mean, I ask you, as I would ask myself, this is the Lord's day. How many hours are there in the week? I don't even remember. 100, what are there? Somebody quickly do the math. 176, something like that? I don't know. Anyhow, there's a lot of hours in a week. How many of them do you give to the pursuit of God? And how many do we give to the pursuit of pleasure? And it would seem often that the church, even in our days, is more concerned with the sensual than the spiritual. Well, in verses 2 through 11, the preacher names ways that he sought satisfaction through pleasure. Number of verses 2 and 3 through fun and frolic. Sometimes I like to read newspaper bloopers. And I get these occasionally from different people, you know, an email or whatever. And I read them and I laugh. I can beat somebody if they came by, they think I'm crazy. I'm sure they're going to start raving mad. I'm sitting there just carrying on and laughing. I laugh till my face hurts. You ever done that? Just laugh till your muscles kind of freeze. But when I get through with all that, I mean, it was nice. I enjoyed the diversion. But at the end of the day, what has that really brought me? What has that really served? And so the preacher says, I'm going to pursue it. I'm going to pursue this through fun and frolic. But you know, after a while, laughter grows stale. And it doesn't really bring any lasting satisfaction or meaning, does it? It's kind of the way, and he says that in verse 2. He says, I said, of laughter it is mad, and of pleasure what use is it? That's sort of the way I feel sometime after I've watched a movie. I get through watching or read a particular book, and I get through reading, and I go, why did I waste my time doing that? That was pointless. Not getting anything from it. It was a waste of good time. And I only have a limited amount of that. Verses 4 through 11, he turns to more serious pursuits. Moving beyond just the fun and frolic, he turns to creativity and culture. He builds great works. He makes gardens and parks. He plants orchards and he designs irrigation systems whereby he can irrigate the trees of the forest and his orchards and all that he's done. He expands his wealth and he broadens his cultural experiences. He gets these singers, these male and female singers, and he broadens out his cultural experiences. In verse 10, he tells us that he found certain pleasure in these activities. That is verse 10. He says, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. We would say, amen. I understand what he's saying. I had the same experience, and so do you have the same experience. That there is a certain satisfaction in planting a garden and harvesting the garden and having good food to eat and canning food and giving away food. There's a certain satisfaction in looking at a job that you have done and you do it well. You're not ashamed to put your name on. There's completion. There's a sense of satisfaction in that. There is a usefulness. There is a beauty to things around us. I enjoy aesthetic beauty. I enjoy looking at a work of art. I enjoy listening to great classics or classical music. Those things bring a certain amount of pleasure and joy. There is an aesthetic beauty and satisfaction that we get. But it's useful. And as beautiful as these things are, Solomon realized they have no lasting value. The garden will soon be covered by weeds, and the forest will grow up or burn down or be cut down. And all you have to do is leave a house that you've worked so diligently on alone for just a short period of time. And very soon it begins to be reclaimed. And all the beautiful music that are pictures or art, and I've been blessed by God to go many different places and hear and enjoy beautiful sights and sounds. I remember sitting in a particular university in Donetsk listening to these people singing, and it was indescribable, the beauty of their voices. But I can't really, I mean, I can kind of remember it, but that's it. It's gone. My eyes aren't filled with looking at beautiful things, nor my ears satisfied. Because after they sound out, the pleasure and joy begins to abate. I think, again, it's important to note something here, because fundamentalism, what's called Christian fundamentalism, that became popular years ago, has robbed Christianity. And I think has reduced Christianity often to just legalistic thinking that being a Christian means you don't do this, don't do that, and don't do the other thing. And there's and just, you know, it's robbed a richness from Christians. Such things as fun and frolic creativity and culture are not wrong or sinful of themselves. I don't think it's a sin to sit there and read the bloopers and get a good side-shaking laugh. I don't find that to be sinful. Gordon Keddy writes, "I believe that the preacher gave himself to investigate. He did not experiment with gross sin. He simply analyzed some of the apparent otherwise harmless or ostensibly productive ways in which a person or people amuse themselves. Austerity is not godliness. It's not sinful to laugh or to enjoy the pleasures of life that God has given us. Food and song and wine are not wicked. Now, they can be. We are to enjoy God's creation. God derives certain satisfaction from the world that He made. He made, as you read through creation, you'll see every day He created. And it said God would look at what He created and He would say, and it's good. And it's good. And at the end He said, it's very good. In other words, it's, if I may say it this way, there's a sense of divine satisfaction that God gathered or gleaned from His creation, from what He has made. And again, just in the same way as you and I get satisfaction. There's nothing wrong with having a beautiful flower garden. My wife loves her flowers, and I don't think that's a sin. I think it's a very beautiful, peaceful, serene setting that she's worked on to walk into the courtyard and enjoy the beauty of the flowers. That's not sin. You know, a person doesn't have to live and wear be a Johnny Cash always dressed in black. God has given us a world, a creation that He has made. And He pronounced it good. Now, sin corrupted it. I know that. But we were to enjoy of His creation. Now, all of these things, art and culture, they bring joy. They're not of themselves wrong or sinful. If a person enjoys the opera, it's not a sin for them to go to the opera or a play. But all of these things are gifts from God. They are not God. They are not God. They're gifts from God. And it's sin when they replace God. It is a sin in my mind when a person forsakes the worship of God for something else. Yes, they have sinned. They have replaced their responsibility and what they're to do to God with something else. That's wrong. That's a sin. But it's not sinful to enjoy these things, but it's sinful when we replace God with them or we pursue them and enjoy them without thanksgiving. Can you really thank God? This is a question I've often asked couples, and especially in times of counseling, and questions arise of what's sin and what's not sin. And some things are very clear. I've just been talking about austerity doesn't mean that's godliness. That those two things don't equal each other. A question is, can I receive this with thanksgiving and be thankful? And God tells me I am to receive the things of His hands with thankfulness. My time, my family, blessings of my life, art. We are to receive those things as goodnesses from our good God. Blessings with thankfulness. But alone, by themselves, they never bring lasting satisfaction. Temporary, yes. There again, I think sometimes that's where the boat's missed, because sometimes you hear preachers and they say, sin's not fun. Well, yes, it is. Well, sin's fun. I'm here there kidding. Of course it's fun. That's part of the allurement. But afterwards, and these things by themselves do not bring satisfaction. So let's say I'm the biggest farmer in Wayne County. And I've given my life to planting and harvesting. There is no, that's no sin in being that, is there? But what at the end of my life, that's all I have. Oh. Then the preacher says, vanity of vanities. You have pursued that which will give you no lasting satisfaction or meaning in life. Verses 12 through 23, death comes to all. He returns to that theme. And he observes in verses 12 through 17 that death comes to all. It matters not who they are, what they have done. He says the same thing that happens to the fool will happen to him. And there is no difference in that. And in verses 13 through 23, he concludes, if this is all there is, if this life is it, then these things are empty and there is no lasting value or good. If death is where it all ends, then all is vanity. And that old song again from my childhood, if that's all there is, my friend, comes to mind. And basically that's what the preacher's saying. If this is it, if you get, you know, that bumper sticker, who gets the most toys wins, if that's all there is, well, you're living a pointless life. As Keddie writes, life is a little different from a pirate's walk down the plank. If your life is just getting stuff of this world, it's equivalent to walking the plank. Because all you're going to get to the end, when you get to the end of the plank, is you're going to die. You're going to drown. If that's it, then nothing gained. Everything's lost. Verses 24 through 26, the preacher moves beyond despair to finding satisfaction. He does not leave us in despair, but he shows us hope and meaning of satisfaction. He observes that what has become a burden, an endless cycle of life, ought to be joyful. That true satisfaction comes from knowing God, that God gives life, and enjoying life. Notice again what he says in verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. He is saying that there is to be meaning and joy and happiness in the journey, in the walk, that these things are meant to bring a certain amount of satisfaction and completeness in God. That what has become a burden to us so often, life, the preacher is saying, ought not to be. And if all you're doing is plotting, simply one foot ahead of the next foot, everything is a burden. It's no joy, it's joyless. And all I'm doing is trying to get through the moment till the next moment because I hope the next moment's going to be better than the moment I'm in. The preacher said, you're not exactly viewing things right. Isn't it strange that we live most of our lives for tomorrow? I mean, who of us is not guilty of that, you know, in our life? Oh, we live for tomorrow because tomorrow it's going to be better. And in living for tomorrow, I don't live the life that God has given me today. And the preacher is writing here and he's saying, there is nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Because he says, this is from the hand of God. Now, he's given us a clue here. He's given us a statement about finding meaning and satisfaction in life. Number one, viewing life as the goal, as a goal, not the goal. Viewing life as a goal, not simply something that I have to do to get somewhere else. But life is a goal. We're not just about getting through life. But we're also about enjoying what God has given us in life. Most of us, again, we live for tomorrow, but it's not just the destination. It's the journey to the destination, he says, that you need to receive as a gift from the hand of God. When our children were small, we would travel somewhere. I was bad about seeing a road and going, I wonder where that goes. Or I think I ought to get us there and go off down a road. And the children would ask me, Daniel, are we lost? Are we lost? No, you can't get lost on an expedition. We're on an expedition. You can't get lost. It's just a journey. We're just out here trying to find out where this road goes. How can we be lost? We're finding out. You know, but you know, if you go through all of life, just your biggest goal in life is to get out of it. Well, the preacher says, no. This too, life too, is God's gift. And that is his second point that he makes to us in verse 24b through 26. He says, this also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? This too, life too, is from the hand of God. It is the gift of God. Our goal is to, a goal is to live our life realizing that the journey is part of what God has given us. And that it's a gift. It's a gift. It's not something that's poison I have to take. It's not simply the remedy to a problem. It's a gift. It's a gift of God's grace that you have life and that you have the life that you now have. But you go, oh, preacher, you don't know what's going on in my life. No, I don't know everything that's going on in everybody's life. You don't know all the things going on in my life either. But life is God's gift. And part of what we're to do is to enjoy every day the toil, our living, our families, all about us, our jobs. Just to live it. Sola Dea Gloria. To the glory of God alone. And when you begin to live that way, then the mundane begins to take on purpose. And it doesn't take away the hard disappointments of life. But it does put it in a different perspective. We'll probably talk more this evening about Pastor Miller, but the last email I had from him, the cancer is also in his bones. And so, you know, his situation's bad. But in every email, he's praising God. Every email, he's saying, God too will use this cancer for His glory and my good. Now that makes all the difference in the way one approaches life. I'm going through life, and you feel like today, well, you know, I can't see over the edge. My fingernails are bloodied. I understand. My fingernails get bloodied. But we've got to learn to look to God and receive of God life as a goal and live our lives to the glory of our Lord. And that's what the preacher exhorts and concludes is the meaning of finding satisfaction. So, are you like Mick Jagger? I can't get no satisfaction. Is that your song? Is that the only chord you're hitting? Even when you get what you dream about, and you get it. Oh, that's fun for a minute or two. Pretty soon, you find out, I'm not happy. I wonder how many of us are just going through the motions. We're not really living life to the glory of God. We're just simply going through the motions of life. Doing what's in front of me to do without really thinking about it or being thankful to God. Or are you like those that the prophet Haggai described? Haggai wrote, "You looked for much, and behold, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I blew it away, I being God. Why? Declares the Lord of hosts. Because of my house that lies in ruins, while each of you busies himself with his own house." And he goes on ahead and talks about having that bag, putting your money in a bag with a hole in it. So God, through the prophet Haggai, is asking the question, making the point. You're looking for a lot, and you got it. You took it home, and what happened to it? Why is that? Because there's a lack of the, for God alone be the glory. My interests are all about me and not enough about God. Again, it's not that the having or the enjoyment or the pleasure is sin. It's when those things become the surrogate for God that they're sin. When they replace the Lord, that they're wrong. Or are you living life as God intended it? With God at the center, or are you on a journey in which you are amazed at His grace and goodness? Do you wake up every morning like the prophet Jeremiah and behold the mercies of the Lord and how they are new morning by morning? And you're amazed when you wake up in the morning. I'm still here. And I'm amazed that God still loves me. And even though I've got X, Y, and Z and 14 flat tires and the cows are out, it's part of the journey. God is a gracious God. Are you truly thankful? Are you a worshiper of God? I know I must quit, but I believe that many believers are confused and they're dazed. And I think many are weak spiritually because they've lost the means God has appointed for satisfaction. The means that God has appointed for joy. The means that God has appointed for rest. Brother Jeff mentioned in his opening prayer today of the Lord's Day and how God is so good. And I truly believe that one of the reasons that we find such spiritual apathy and weakness today is the Lord's Day is just blown off. People don't have a concept of it. This isn't the only day you have to do your stuff. This is God's day. He gave you six. Go do your stuff. But He said, this day is made for man. And you know, we could get into all the sociological and psychological reasons you want to about increased depression, increased breakdowns, etc., divorces, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you love the Lord thy God, then keep His word. We don't have to explain it all psychologically and sociologically. But they're there. They're the reasons. Worship, public and private. One can't replace the other. One should build and feed upon the other one. But I wonder sometimes how much do I really worship the Lord during the week. And there's a lot of time my despondency and blueness and feeling overcome simply by the fact, due to the fact, I'm not worshiping God as I ought. Fellowship of the saints. Woe to those ships that sail alone. Woe to that person who thinks they can do it by themselves. You are the prime target. And you've already lost part of a lot of the battle and you don't even aware of it. As the old Puritan said, Satan watches for those ships that sail without convoy. You're asking for attack. But God invites you to Himself. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes his refuge in Him. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. And again, Christ said, if anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink. Satisfaction is found in the Lord. Living our life is a gift from God. Living our life to the glory of God. And ultimately, I will be satisfied when I awake in His likeness.
We invite you to worship with us at Emmanuel Baptist Church, located at 1618 Waycross Highway, Jessup, Georgia. Visit our website at www.ebcjessup.net for information about the church, service times, and to listen to other sermons.